Okay. So, Alan, the first question is, you know, a little bit about your background and career. How'd you get into real estate?
I got into real estate through the hotel industry. I went to the hotel school at Cornell, joined a hotel developer shortly thereafter, and ultimately made my way to Pru, who at the time that I joined them was the largest owner of hotels in the country, I believe, with over 125 hotels at the time. And so from kind of the hotel sector, I made my way through other parts of the real estate industry and ultimately to here.
How long have you been with Pru?
I've been with Pru for 25 years. And, I think a lot of people tend to be amazed that someone would stay at an institution that long. I think one of the things that has kind of marked my career here is, and one of the reasons I've stayed, is I've had an opportunity to do a lot of different things while I've been here. And frankly, the capacity to do that wide variety of things certainly helped a lot in preparing me for the role I'm in today.
One of my observations from doing business with Pru for umpteen years as a banker is that Pru really grew its people very well.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're sort of the third in this tradition that was started with Bernard and then with Charlie Lowry and yourself, and it's all its people who've been inside, you know, who've grown into larger positions. Is that, you know, something consciously that Pru does and that, you know, people should say, try to emulate as they think about running their companies?
I think so. I mean, you know, I was very fortunate to have some terrific sponsors in Bernard and Charlie and had relationships with them over an extended period of time. And the topic of succession planning in corporate life gets a lot of attention. But I do think within our organization, being the kind of institution it is something people take very seriously. And what I've found, frankly, particularly over the recent past, as we've had organizational change where we've had succession planning we've had to put in place, you know, many of our clients invest with an institution like Prudential because they perceive us as being the sort of institution that can handle that sort of thing well and invest time and money in developing people so that we can have continuity of staff over time and that there's not disruption in that regard.
What do you think has been the biggest change that you've observed in the past 5 years? Because this has been a difficult 5 years, you know, from 2007 to today. What impresses you as, that's really different?
Well, it obviously has been a very challenging period, but on the other hand, I think there are a couple observations I would make. The globalization of our business, if you will, continues at a very healthy pace. The influence of very large global investors over how we raise and invest capital has only grown over that period of time. And I think the perception of people of the importance of the institutional affiliation that we have in positioning us as a sort of trusted partner and counterparty with whom people want to do business has also been really important. I think one of the things that has served us very well is that, you know, Prudential started its first fund, PRISA, in 1970. You know, so we've been in this business for over 40 years, and we take a long-term view to it. We've been in it a long time. We focus on sort of a long-term, both in terms of the products we create and the client relationships we try to develop. And I think, you know, clients, even when we make mistakes, because of that, our clients give us an opportunity to get it right. And the fact is that we're all going to make mistakes in this business. There'll be times when you get the cycle wrong, you do this, what have you. But when you have relationships with your clients that are based on transparency and trust and that sort of thing, people give you an opportunity to fix it. And we've been very fortunate in that regard.
if we sort of say, okay, we're probably at the bottom of this current cycle. May not have turned the corner, but we're at the corner.
Mm-hmm.
How are you starting to shape Prudential's efforts for the next 5 years? What do you see as the next set of changes you got to think through?
Well, to tell you the truth, we started that process in, believe it or not, probably 2009, because we felt like if we solely focused on just reacting to the crisis of the moment without looking forward, we would find ourselves coming out of the financial crisis in a position where there were new opportunities and strategies we might want to pursue, but we weren't positioned to take advantage of them. So in the time frame of around 2009, we were very aggressive in bringing in new talent to the organization to address areas we thought were key opportunities. Foremost among those would have been opportunities to invest in debt in both the U.S. and Europe. And that has been very successful for us. It, given the dysfunction in the capital markets, it's an opportunity we think will be sustainable for some time. And it's one where, you know, again, we're very optimistic in terms of how it will continue to evolve over time. I think in other aspects, you know, generally speaking, we're trying to, in some respects, simplify what we do. We're trying to focus on fewer things, but focus on those things where we can really build market distinction and build scale. The debt strategies are one example. Among emerging markets, the market we're focused on now is China in particular. And in that market, we're really focused on building off the credibility and experience we have as an investor in shopping centers in Southeast Asia to create a platform for investing in shopping centers in China. So again, not trying to do everything in that market, trying to focus on one thing we've done well and focus on doing it in scale and over time. But it's very much about taking a relatively patient approach to building it right, building it in a way that we're comfortable that we can manage the multitude of risks that come along with doing business in a market like that.
Recently, there was an article that talked about the sustainability report, the sustainability challenge. And it really was, I think, just a knockout punch to the industry, wake-up call that Pruitt set a very ambitious challenge for itself, exceeded that challenge, and was just doing a lot of things to create this value.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could, you know, spend a couple minutes just sort of bring me into how this all came together and where do you think it's going?
Well, obviously, sustainability has become a very important topic. It also just, I think, relates to a philosophy associated with what our investors expect of us, which is that they clearly expect us to deliver good investment performance, which is why they hire us, but they also care about how we go about doing it. And sustainability is one aspect of that. I think that we felt like it was important that we begin to take steps to lend greater substance to what the sustainability programs were all about. That ultimately, it is about creating value. It is about saving energy. And if you aren't very explicit, in effect, setting some financial targets that are important to do, I think that it can, you know, lack substance in some regard. In many respects, I think we've wanted to make sure that as it pertains to the low-hanging fruit associated with sustainability, that we were doing that. That's where, in effect, where you start. And even the process of taking advantage of the low-hanging fruit is not an easy undertaking, because a lot of what you're talking about is changing human behavior and how people act at a property level, and how this accumulation of little things that people do ultimately accumulate into meaningful impact, especially if you're someone like us who's, you know, got a meaningful level of assets under management. So that process, I think we've been working through, and I think we're happy with the progress that we've made. But I think what, you know, when you start this process, what you're acutely aware of is there's a lot more room to go. But it's important, having taken these steps and sort of created a sense of accountability, that this isn't just about good public relations, it's about really creating tangible financial results.
Yeah, no, I think one of the great issues has been people trying to figure out how to, you know, capitalize the savings or the profits or however they want to define it, to be able to say that, you know, we have created value and this is, you know, it's real, it's relevant, it's measurable, and it's a standard we can hold ourselves to. I think your differentiation between changing behavior and the fact that there's passive things you can do, like the sensors and things like that, but you really got to change behavior. You got to be active.
Yeah.
And you got to get people to participate. All right. Off the interview.
Yes.
Onto a couple of
questions. Okay. Sure.
As we sort of go into 2013, are you hearing from your clients, investors, people you're meeting with, that they're looking for a change in strategy? They want to become, I don't know, more active, more emerging markets, more Europe, more Asia, more secondary.
Yeah. Some of this is obviously somewhat self-selecting because of where we're focused. But, you know, what I get the sense of is, on the one hand, people are flirting with wanting to take more risk, but on the other hand, finding it hard to do so. If you looked at where we have been successful raising capital over the last 24 months, it has been disproportionately, and this is around the world, disproportionately in strategies that are core-like in their character or debt-related strategies. And what they all have in common generally is preservation of capital and yield. And even in the debt strategies that we've been pursuing, one of the appealing features about them is the relative yield that's available in doing those. But I certainly continue to see a lot of capital flowing to those sorts of strategies. European debt is clearly a favored sector right now. But even in the U.S., we've seen a very healthy level of interest in those sorts of strategies as well. I think that, you know, I hear discussion of, you know, people wanting to move to secondary markets and take advantage of that arbitrage between core price, you know, the kind of prime gateway market pricing and the secondary market pricing. But what's not entirely clear to me that is, in that kind of vernacular, when people are talking about secondary markets, I think what they're really talking about is non-gateway markets. And so it's moving out of the top five into the sort of next 5 to 15. It's mm-hmm. not moving into, you know, the, you know, markets that kind of go from 20 to 30 in the, you know, MSAs, if you follow me. And so, you know, a lot of people wouldn't think of Atlanta and Dallas and markets like that as, quote, secondary. But in this environment, they're not gateway cities by any means. But I think it's hard for people to get their heads around doing that, frankly, because of the lack of economic momentum. And, it makes it a little bit of a crapshoot because, you know, ultimately, we do need fundamentals to, ultimately, fundamentals matter. And while it's great that there's no construction, and even at low levels of economic growth, fundamentals improve, I mean, making a bet on some of these secondary markets that are relatively thin, both in terms of tenant demand and investor appetite, you know, it's a little bit of a crapshoot still.
Right. As people remark to me, where's my liquidity?
Right.
You know, I've got this list of things I sort of need. I need job growth. I need in-migration. but eventually I need to have some confidence that this is not a roach motel that I'm checking into.
Right.
Speaking about raising capital, it appears we're starting to see a real differentiation in the market between the, not so much the larger firms, but the firms that have been in it for a long time, have deep roots, have been transparent, brought the bad news to the table early, and not been afraid to tell their investors, versus firms that have either legacy issues still to work out or, you know, are very boutique. And, you know, you sense this is becoming, you know, that as you said before, size matters is part one. Or maybe part two is you need to be the most local of local sharpshooters. But if you're not in those two games, you could find yourself having a very tough time.
I think people, you know, in this environment, regardless of who you are, track record and credibility is what matters. And so, you know, for an institution like ours, we've been around a long time. I think we have a good track record, good client relationships. We've handled our missteps well, and, you know, as far as that goes. We have the capacity to co-invest in funds, which in this environment, you know, is important to some institutions. And we continue to launch new funds and strategies. And so I think there is a group, and look, for us, you know, there isn't a boutique alternative for us. We either are kind of a big global firm, because to be in the middle is sort of a no man's land for an organization like ours, I think. But I think that there clearly are some folks who, you know, if they found themselves in a period of time where, you know, their track record may not be perfect, they made some missteps in handling client relationships, they don't have capital to put in these funds, you know, or what have you, I think it's really tough. The other one is just startup firms. I think that's a really tough proposition for people right now. So again, I think it comes down to, you know, track record, client relationships, and that sort of thing.
Let's go back to dead debt strategies, just so I have that clear. I'm presuming what you're talking about is, you know, acquiring existing.
No, this is buying it. Generally speaking, this is, you know, we're doing it in two places. We're doing it in the U.S. and we're doing it in Europe.
Right.
And by and large, not exclusively, but by and large, this is originating new. This is subordinated debt, in our, so it's mezzanine.
Okay.
And in Europe, it's basically exclusively a new origination strategy. And here in the U.S., it is primarily new origination, you know, refinancing, that sort of thing. New origination, but we do have the capacity to buy paper if we want, that sort of thing. The strategy here is a little broader.
Okay. Out of curiosity, you know, we see the large institutional investors talking about, you know, everyone's writes about their need for yield, concurrent income for beneficiaries, and the huge gap between what they're getting and what their actuarial assumptions are. But surprisingly, I haven't heard of many instances where they've come to a Prudential or somebody said, we'd like to get a lot of money into the mortgage market. And it may not hit the bigger bogey, but it gives us a solid return on a relative value basis.
Mm-hmm.
Have I missed what's going on?
No. It's one of those things. We've seen, you know, again, our sister organization, PMCC,
right,
does that, but they've seen some activity, but not a lot. And I think that, you know, part of it is, as I think you know, part of it is just the dilemma of where do they put it, what's the benchmark, is it handled by the fixed income team, is it handled by real estate, you know, it's sort of like they don't have a place for it. And so where we've seen it happen is where you have a CIO who looks at it and says, this is good relative value, and tells the fixed income team and the real estate team get together and figure this out. But where we've raised much more capital is in the mezzanine space, where, again, for whatever reasons, it tends to fall where it, as a real estate strategy, it's higher return. Even some of the more conservatively positioned mezzanine that we've been doing, which would say produce an 8-10% yield, is, I think, very compelling to people. And even though it's not long duration paper or what have you, given what's available in the market today for yield-oriented investors, you know, that's a very attractive position to be in.
Yeah, so someone said to me that they're looking at anything that has an R in it. And I said, what do you mean? He said, refinance, rehabilitation, renovation, reposition. You know, he says, anything that requires an R, you know, is a strategy today. Rescue capital, preferred mezzanine, whatever it might be, because they feel, you want to back good properties, you know, but owners and the owner may be a little bit upside down.
Yeah.
We don't want to go the other, we don't want to start with the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the strategies we're pursuing in Europe versus U.S. are a little different. Clearly in Europe, the focus is on high-quality collateral, high-quality sponsors, capital structures that need fixing. And in the U.S., we're prepared, we tend to take a little more risk in terms of market locations and, you know, some of the asset quality. This is all relative, of course.
Right.
But in Europe, it really is a, you know, focus on high-quality assets, high-quality sponsors. You know, we're not taking risk on those things.
We've seen a little M&A in the investment manager business. And just like everyone talks about, there'll be M&A in the REIT business, because eventually, if you talk about it enough, it will actually happen. Mm-hmm. Do you see that there will be opportunities for large firms like Prudential to expand their assets under management, their platforms, because there will be boutique opportunities, firms that just, you know, are not well capitalized enough?
Well, you know, I think there may be opportunities. It's a question in my mind of whether it's really an effective growth strategy in the sort of business that we're in. You know, in my mind, you know, there the complications around growing this sort of a business through M&A are pretty significant. And I think among the most important things for businesses like ours is sort of knowing who you are, having a culture around investing and managing risk and dealing with your clients that has a lot of integrity. And I think it's hard to maintain that and cultivate it through an M&A kind of approach. I think, just speaking for us, we're much more likely to just grow organically. That's not to say we won't bring in teams, as we did for, you know, the debt. We've continued to be very active in recruiting talent. But I think we're much more likely to approach it that way than through an M&A kind of an approach. But I think we've been approached by people are looking for sort of an institutional sponsor. They're looking for someone who can provide co-investment. They're looking for someone who can provide greater access to clients. And so there clearly are folks who are looking for that. But how that plays out, it's not entirely clear to me.
Regulatory corn maze out there. Dodd-Frank, Basel III, Solvency II, you know, for insurance companies in Europe. What's it doing to your business? Is there an impact?
Well, I mean, like everyone, I mean, there's a certain amount of just the, the heightened regulatory issues we're having to respond to like everyone else. And so we spend more time on it, it's more costly, all that stuff. You know, the issues associated with the ongoing kind of banking issues with Europe and Basel III and that sort of thing actually helps some of our strategies. because it heightens the need for the sort of capital, particularly on the debt side, that we can provide. And so, and I think that's part of why we view that opportunity as being relatively sustainable for the time being. It's, you know, I think we're dealing with it just like everyone else. I mean, it's part of the world we operate in, and it's not going to get easier.
If we look at the source of equity and debt, the REITs, the story's pretty well told. CMBS gaining traction, coming back slowly. Fortune has not made the mistakes it made last year, so I think it's maybe getting on a stronger footing. Insurance companies are just about as active as they can be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for them to allocate more capital to real estate above the amount that they've got now takes a lot of work. It's not just a simple, let's put another couple billion in. You know, commercial banks are starting to heal slowly. Is that a fair representation of where the capital markets are?
It feels like it. Yeah.
Are there any new sources on the horizon?
In terms of the debt capital markets, I don't think, you know, there's nothing that I can think of.
Yields too low.
Well, I guess when you say yields to UFD low, you mean private sources, or why aren't we seeing more institutions come into that space?
Well, just some private sources of debt.
Yeah.
Who they're backed by.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, part of it is, I mean, I don't think it's a question of will there be some other parties who come in, but it's sort of like, are they going to be at a level that matters? I mean, the materiality of what we need, it's sort of like the CMBS market is coming back and people were saying, oh, it's, you know, you probably know better the predictions for scale this year than I do, but it's probably, what, 35 to 50 billion this year?
Not that high.
Okay. I was going to say 35, but then I thought maybe I've been a little out of date. But, you know, I was at a ULI event a couple years ago, and Shecky Schechter, who I'm sure you know,
sure.
You know, we were talking about, around the room people were talking about, you know, what are the CMB, what's the kind of bid ask in terms of what CMBS volume was going to be that year. And this was a couple years ago. And the low was around 25 to 30, and he was at like 75 billion. And, or he was at a big, you know, there was a big spread, okay?
Right.
But it's still far below, you know, and so that's never materialized. We haven't gotten out of that sort of, call it 25 to the peak after the financial crisis has been like mid 30s, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so, when you look at the scale of what we need and you say, okay, who could fill that? It's not going to be the insurance company, right? It's not going to be, you know, sovereign wealth funds. I mean, it's just the scale is too big. So I'm not quite sure where it does come from. Presumably the CMBS market should gain traction, but, you know, and I'm not the expert of that market, but it seems to me volatility is the enemy of that market.
Right, clearly.
And we're still in a highly volatile market. So I don't have any bright ideas on that. I'm not quite sure where it all is going to come from.
Well, the only thing I could say to people is, well, if we get into an environment with rising interest rates, at some point yields will start to become attractive.
Yeah.
But we need that to start to happen.
Yeah.
Are you seeing greater competition from offshore investors
here in the U.S.
You
know, I some of our other guys here could give you a better answer, I'm sure. I'm not aware of that, honestly, for the kinds of assets that we've been bidding on. You know, but having said that, I think, you know, two-thirds of what we've done this year has been apartment-related, and so either development or some acquisitions. And so there, you know, you're just fighting it out with the development stuff is through programmatic development with our partners. So there, you know, it's not competitive like in the core space. But, you know, in the core space, you're just fighting it out with the normal institutions around here bidding for that kind of stuff.
Right. And it's a highly, highly sought after.
Oh, yeah.
Commodity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. good to go.
That's it? Well, that was easy.
Well, I got two and a half things done.
There you go.
You know, I'm willing to take that.
Yeah, no, and I but the panel is on.